Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to another Sunday with the Main Course. I'm Alexis McLaughlin, here with Philip Gilmore, sitting in, as always, for Patrick Martins.
Good morning.
We are really excited. We have in studio today Mark Schatzker. He's an award-winning food journalist, author of the book Steak, One Man's Search for the Tastiest Piece of Beef, and most recently author of The Dorito Effect, just came out May 5th. So we're really excited to have you here today.
Thank you.
So I guess we'll just start and, you know, dive into the book a little bit. We're really excited to get this in.
Great cover.
Yeah, great cover for all the listeners that are watching in right now.
That's the one thing I didn't do, but anyway.
Great.
You were saying there's Dorito flavor crystals on the cover?
That was my plan, but they never went for it. For those who haven't seen it, the writing, the font, looks like it's made out of crushed tortilla chips. And my great hope was that it would actually be scratch and sniff. But
I love it.
Yeah, don't go into Barnes & Noble's and lick the book covers, though. They don't like that much.
No, that would be good, because then they'll have to buy it.
Oh, you lick it, you buy it.
That's right.
Did you come across any challenges using the word Dorito in your title?
My publisher has a legal department, and they looked at that. But my understanding is that it's fair use. And my book is not about how Doritos are killing America. My book is about how everything is becoming more like Doritos, and how Doritos and how they were invented tells us so much about how our food system has changed.
Yeah.
So it's not really a screed against Doritos. It's more of a lens of understanding what went wrong.
So you talk about a few different things within, you know, our modern food system, and the one that first caught me was the excerpt that ran in the New York Post about how chicken today doesn't taste like chicken used to taste. And I think that that's an idea that people don't understand. They know chicken looks different and that we produce it differently, but the idea that chicken doesn't taste the same and how that occurs over, you know, or why that that's happened.
It's interesting. I'd argue there's very few people who live in North America who've experienced the flavor of real chicken, because it's been gone for an awfully long time. My dad was born before the Second World War, and I gave him some chicken that I got a farmer to produce, and he said, my God, I haven't tasted chicken like that since just after the war. So it really has been a long time. But basically, the story of chicken is very much like the story of the Dorito. It's become something extremely bland that we season very aggressively to make it palatable. It wasn't always this way.
Without spoiling it too much for people who actually buy the book and read the book, could you tell the story a little bit about the lady in Kansas? Yeah. I found that so endearing. I'm actually from Kansas.
There's a woman. She's from Wichita. She went to a
I'm actually from Wichita.
Excellent. Yeah. You may know her.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And she went to a store in McPherson called Crable's Meats, and she bought a chicken called a Barred Rock. She had been trying for years to make a chicken and dumplings that her husband would like, and her husband never liked it. He just said, it doesn't taste like my mother's. It had been decades. I mean, to the point that, I mean, this was a lost cause. This was never going to happen. But finally, one day, she bought this chicken called a Barred Rock. It just said it on the label. Other than that, it looked kind of like a chicken. I mean, if you really studied it closely, you'd see that the breast was smaller, the legs were a little bit longer, and the skin was, in fact, even more yellow than the so-called free-range chicken. As it should be. But she took it home, and she cooked it. She tried one last time. I'm going to make chicken and dumplings for my husband, and he finally said, you've done it. This is my mother's chicken and dumplings. And the difference was not the recipe. It was not whether she was using like a copper pan or all these things that modern chefs become obsessed with having to do with technique or their equipment. It had to do with the chicken. And that's because chickens have changed. Chickens are nothing like they were 60 years ago. And all that time, her problem was that she was using the wrong chicken. So this particular chicken that she bought, the Barred Rock, was raised by a guy named Frank Reese, who raises heirloom chickens. And they're raised the way chickens were raised probably around the Second World War. They take about 16 to 18 weeks to get big. And they spend a lot of their life outside eating blades of grass, bugs, seeds, anything they can get their beaks on, really. And that profoundly influences the way they taste in a huge way.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think we've known it with farm-raised salmon versus wild-caught salmon for a while. Just the idea that, you know, natural diet fortifies, you know, the meat with, you know, micronutrients and at greater levels and, you know, just a non-natural diet. We work with Frank a lot, so we visit, you know, I've had the good fortune to visit Frank Reese on his farm a few times, and he always touts that there's actually higher levels of omega-3 and, you know, other nutrients in his birds when they're tested at Kansas State University. And I was surprised to learn that. I'd never really made the connection about the trade-off when you're creating a bird to grow so fast, like you detail in your book, and everything is made to grow faster and, you know, hold for market longer and be bigger and produce more fruit per, tomato plant, that you lose a lot of the components in them that not only are important for flavor, but also for nutrition.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason chicken's so interesting is because it went from being a relatively unpopular meat in the Second World War and prior, nowhere near as popular as beef, to becoming our number one meat. We've cranked up the production unbelievably. We've cranked up production efficiency. I was talking about how Frank's birds take 14 to 16 weeks to 18 weeks to get big. We do it now in about 6 weeks. All our chickens are confined. They consume an ultra-high energy diet, and they get big really quickly. Well, on the one hand, you can say, well, this is great. They're more feed efficient. We have more chicken. There truly is a chicken in every pot. But these things all come with the trade-offs, and we paid for it in some way. And the way we paid for it that we experience is flavor. But beneath all that, we've also paid for it in nutrition. Frank is right. Those pasture-raised chickens, there's more omega-3s. They're basically more nutrient-dense across the board. A chicken is what it eats, just the way we are what we eat. And what you feed a chicken is going to profoundly affect how that chicken tastes and its physiology, everything about it. If we didn't kill the modern chickens at 6 weeks, they would get metabolic disease and they would die on their own because the diet we feed them is not sustainable from a, you know, kind of a health and longevity point of view.
Yeah, me and Alexis were talking about it earlier, but maybe you can expound on it about like how it, like 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 1,000,000 years ago, basically all living creatures, including plants, I think, had DHA omega in them, or maybe not plants, I don't know.
No, well,
but that it all, but because everything was part of the same food chain, because is that true?
Yeah, well, omega-3 fats. This is an interesting one. Omega-3 fats are a family of polyunsaturated fats, yes. And they come in different lengths. And the big long ones are the complex ones that you get in fish. DHA is sort of the very popular one. You get it in fish oil, salmon, mackerel, things like that. The ones that plants produce are a little bit simpler. And organisms consume the plants, let's say terrestrial plants, because the long ones actually come from algae in the ocean. And they deposit that in their flesh. The interesting thing about chickens is that chickens can actually convert the simple omega-3s into long-chain omega-3s. So when you eat one of these heirloom birds, you're actually getting some of those same omega-3s that you get in salmon and mackerel. Most terrestrial creatures don't do that all that well, but chickens at one time were a pretty good source for those kinds of fats. No longer. I mean, that is not happening.
Because of their diet?
Well, there's actually not even that much omega-3s, period, in chickens now, because the stuff we feed them, a lot of corn, some soybeans, much higher in omega-6s. So yeah. When you start to look at omega-6, omega-3 ratios, which is the kind of thing that lipid scientists do, nutritionists, chicken's one of the worst. You get these ratios of omega-6s to omega-3s, like up to 40 to 1, which is really bad. They're thinking for the... A good range for a diet would be something like 5 to 1, 10 to 1. I mean, perhaps ideally 1 to 1. You don't see that so much anymore. Mm.
You know, I really love the book for its interesting approach to storytelling, because I think there was a lot of, you know, information that you brought up. There's, I mean, it was clearly very well researched. And I was most surprised for someone that works, you know, works for a company selling heirloom and heritage breeds of livestock, that, you know, that there you could make it entertaining with the stories and kind of connect it back to these ideas that I understood but I hadn't conceptualized yet. Flavor, how it's changed our perception of food. I don't know if you could talk a little bit about the nutritional wisdom.
Yeah, that is one of the...
I know it exists, but I hadn't really put it together.
So yes, nutritional wisdom is an idea I had not heard of before I started researching the book. And nutritional wisdom, it's... sometimes people refer to it as the wisdom body, but it's the idea that your body is on some level aware of its own needs. Now, there's some really good, very simple examples of this, like thirst. When you require water, you become thirsty. So that's nutritional wisdom. The question is, how far does that go? And for a long time, people thought it went pretty far. And then starting around the 60s and 70s in the human world, that became very unfashionable, to the point that the prevailing view in the human sciences and psychology of nutrition and nutrition is that we have no idea what we want our desires. The food that we desire is at odds with our nutritional needs. So the idea that there's such a thing as nutritional wisdom is terribly passé in the human sciences. Oddly enough, when you walk across campus and go into the ecology department or the animal sciences department, nutritional wisdom is raging, where it's considered foundational that animals have some ability to meet their own needs. When you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, it makes a lot of sense. If you're a creature out there in the forest and you need to survive, and that's what we once were, this is really what's referred to as the omnivore's dilemma. You have diverse needs. You need protein. You need energy. You need vitamins. You need minerals. How do you go about getting that? There's lots of things you can eat. There's a bunch of things that are poisonous, but you need things in various quantities. For example, pregnant women need more protein than women who are not pregnant. Children have a much higher energy requirement than grown adults because they're growing. So how you have this problem, you have to interact with your environment and you have to get the nutrients that you need to survive. And you don't have a PhD in nutrition, what do you do? So this is why you have a palate. This is why you desire certain things, why certain foods seem delicious at certain times, because you need to get what you need. So that is basically the idea of nutritional wisdom. What I fought to do, the whole point of this book really is to argue that this does exist in humans and that we've been screwing it up. And the way we've been screwing it up is very evident in our level of health, particularly when you look at things like obesity and metabolic disease. The language of nutrition in nature is flavor. The whole reason that foods have flavor is because flavor is the way we perceive the nutrition in something before we eat it and while we're eating it. That's why a steak tastes like a steak and an orange tastes like an orange. If there was no such thing as nutritional wisdom, they'd taste the same. But there's a reason they seem the way they seem. So what's interesting about flavor is how much it has changed. That's why we talked about the example of the chicken, how bland chicken has got. And this is really the point of my book, is that everything that's wrong with food, and also right with food, is best understood through flavor. And very broadly speaking, the two things we've done is the food that we grow is getting blander and blander. All the whole foods that we're supposed to eat don't taste very good. It's been on a downward trajectory since the late 1940s, and everything is approaching a state of cardboard. On the other side, flavor technology has gotten incredibly powerful. Synthetic flavors existed prior to the 1950s, but they were not that common. They were not very good. There was a device that came on the market, I think it was 1955, the first commercial gas chromatograph went on sale. And this was an amazing machine because you could take foods, oranges, steak, tomatoes, cherries, and you could finally figure out what these tiny complex molecules were that made them seem flavorful. you know, cherries have macronutrients in them, like starches and sugars and so forth, but what makes a cherry taste like a cherry are the flavor compounds. And the gas chromatograph gave us the ability to say, ah, it's these 35 molecules. I've nailed it. I can put it in a soft drink. I can put it in a candy. I can put it in like a packaged dessert. And
take all the bad things and just leave the good things.
That's right. And that's what we've done. So Whole Foods getting blander, processed food is getting more flavorful. It's actually got to the point now where it's starting to blur. Everything's gotten so bland that we're actually starting to add flavor back to Whole Foods. So you can go to a supermarket and you can buy a chicken that has flavoring added to it.
It's fortified with chicken.
It's, yes, with some simulacrum of chicken to make it taste like chicken is perhaps supposed to taste. But guess what? When you put those flavors in, guess what you're not putting in? The nutrition. So if flavor is this language, this projection of nutrition that food has, when you sprinkle in the flavorings, you're fooling people. You're deceiving them. You're creating the sensation of nutrition that doesn't actually exist, which is why, for example, fruit-flavored drinks, most soft drinks are essentially fruit-flavored. Lemon, like some of them overtly like lemon-lime, but even colas are primarily citrus-flavored. They taste good. People wouldn't consume them if they didn't taste good, but we're not delivering. You present this this experience of fruitiness, but you're just hitting them with sugar. It's just sugar, 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 sugar. And I think the reason I think this is so important is because we've been caught in this weird nutritional vortex where everything is about a nutrient. It's sugar. Sugar's killing us. Sugar's killing us. Carbs are killing us. Fat is killing us. On some physiological level, that stuff is happening. Food does do stuff to your body. But the big question is, why are we eating food? And that's a behavioral question. No one sets out to eat too much sugar. No one sets out. There's no one in the world who wants to eat too many carbs. No one wants to eat themselves into a diabetic state. The question is, what is driving this behavior? And flavor is what drives the behavior. We all eat, even people on a crazy diet are still looking for flavor. There's all these specialized cookbooks, whether you're on the DASH diet or the Paleo diet or the Mediterranean diet, because I really want it to taste good. We are, all of us, on a mission to find delicious food. It is our number one instinct, even more important than reproduction. You got to eat to live. And when you start to understand how we've screwed up that language, how we've incentivized the wrong food and disincentivized the right food and essentially ruined the right food, it tells us a lot about what we're all doing and why we're all eating the wrong thing.
And it addresses why we've seen this in the last 50, 60 years and why this is not, such a widespread pandemic before.
That's right.
This time.
And the interesting thing is that obesity has gotten so much worse in the last 30 or 40 years. Because this is the problem I have with the prevailing view in the human sciences that we're essentially wired for calories. Well, if that's true, why weren't people fat in the 1960s? I mean, a few people were, but it's just been getting much, 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 much worse. The calories were available. Why weren't people, especially rich people, over-consuming them? So I think flavor is sort of the missing piece of the puzzle that tells us where things went wrong. I mean, you can also think of it this way. If you think of junk food, if you snapped your fingers and got rid of all that flavor technology, you'd basically be getting rid of junk food because it just wouldn't work. The reason I called the book The Dorito Effect is because Doritos themselves are a really interesting story. The guy who invented Doritos, he was the VP of sales and marketing for Frito-Lay, and he took his family on a trip to California. And he found a little Mexican shack, and he pulled in, and he ordered some tortilla chips, and he tasted them, and he thought, these are going to be the next big thing for Frito-Lay, tortilla chips. And he went back to Dallas, and he presented them to the big wigs, and they said, no, we're already doing Fritos. These are basically the same thing. What are you thinking? But he knew better, and he actually funneled some discretionary funds into an offsite facility and developed the tortilla chip concept. He came up with his new name that in sort of a pidgin Mexican Spanish meant little pieces of gold, and he represented it and said, I give you Doritos. And they launched Doritos. And guess what? Doritos almost never made it because the first Doritos were just salted tortilla chips. And in the Southwest, they sold okay. Because people knew there's, a Hispanic influence. You can dip these things into guacamole. You can dip these things into salsa. They're great. But everyone else said, what's the deal with Doritos? They sound Mexican. They don't taste Mexican. And so the guy who invented them had to go in front of the big wigs at Frito-Lay again. And they say, well, what are we going to do about these Doritos that aren't selling well? And this guy knew about the emerging science and technology of flavor, and he said, let's make them taste like taco.
Genius.
And it took off. The next one was nacho cheese. The rest is history. But here's the point. Doritos didn't become a thing without flavor technology. Suddenly, you didn't need to dip them into real food, like avocado or chopped up tomato and hot pepper and cilantro.
What year was this?
This was in the early 60s. I think he had the idea in 1961. Struggling with the dates here. I think 63 was the salted tortilla, mm-hmm. and it was a little later than that that the taco Dorito came along.
What's the chemical that makes the cheese powdery? Do you know what that is?
Oh, maltodextrin?
Yeah, maltodextrin. Yes. It's so amazing to me that, with all the inventions and flavor technology, as you're talking about, that some of these chemicals that have been around since the early 60s and the technology have reemerged with molecular gastronomy in the last, 15 years, because, the chemicals themselves are harmless, but it's everything that they're using them for.
That's right, exactly. Maltodextrin is a great vehicle. If you need to stick your flavoring on something, maltodextrin is a nice... fuzzy molecule.
It basically takes something that's just 100% fat and then turns it into powder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's come back to this conversation, go to a quick commercial break, hear from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Mark Schatzker.
Yay.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, welcome. We're back with Mark Schatzker. We were just talking about some chemical compounds that I can't pronounce, so I'm not going to try. Do you guys want to pick it up?
This is kind of off topic, but it keeps on coming up into my mind.
Phil, you off topic?
No way.
No.
Do you guys know that Chef Boyardee, the original Chef Boyardee, who was, I guess, a cook for the White House, but, really innovated canned foods, but he used to actually grow his own mushrooms for the canned pasta under the factory. He had a basement, and he personally tended to his own mushrooms that he put in the canned
I'd be more food. Impressed if he foraged for them.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that would be cool, too. But he actually used to grow his own mushrooms, which I find fascinating. I wish I could go back in time and actually try,
Original.
Yeah, original.
I actually have never had... Chef Boyardee or SpaghettiOs or anything like that.
It's really not that good.
Yeah.
I had it as a child, and I would say, the McDonald's thing, once every 2 years, I'll just try it. And then you're like, yeah, it was not as good as I remember.
You're absolutely right. And I had that. I used to love Chef Boyardee ravioli as a kid. And it's that saying, you can never go home. You can't. I mean, it's like every time I have a Big Mac, I have this idea from when I was seven what a Big Mac tasted. And you're just like, yeah, that's gone.
I go back and forth with this, the SpaghettiOs or the Big Mac, it's 30 years later or 35 years later. Did it taste different back then?
No question.
No question, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two things. You've changed. It's changed.
So my suggestion is go on eBay and try to find a vintage can of SpaghettiOs, and it'll be delicious. Yeah.
Mm. What is that? What's Botox that develops in cans?
Oh, botulism.
Botulism.
Yeah. Old school.
Vintage that could botulism. Be a thing. Vintage clothing is big. We should make vintage
vintage
eating
food. I'm obsessed with vintage beer cans. I love them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everything has changed in flavor, you know, industrialization and of the, you know, the process of making foods. Another point that you brought up in your book was enriched foods. You know, we enrich our bread, we enrich our rice, and because of that, are we tricking ourselves because of that notion of the nutritional...
Yeah, this is an idea that occurred to me, and I talked about it with many scientists. We put a lot of nutrients in food. We enrich our flour. We've been doing that for a very long time. But now there's things like sports drinks and sweet fruity drinks that have vitamins in them. We tend to think this is a good thing because vitamins are good for you. You can't get too many vitamins, right? Vitamins. To really understand why I think this could be a problem, it's important to understand the work of a behavioral ecologist named Fred Provenza. He worked for many years at the University of Utah. He's retired now, but he's still publishing. Fred is the guy who really made this subject come into focus for me. And I'll tell the story of how he got involved. In 1976, he was doing his PhD, and he basically had to supervise a bunch of goats eating blackbrush. This is going somewhere, believe me. Blackbrush is this kind of scrubby shrub out there in Utah that isn't all that tasty to goats. It's not all that nutritious, but the point was, if you could show that goats could eat blackbrush, maybe they'd eat it all down and you could grow something better, and then you could range your cattle on it and all the rest of it. But what Fred noticed is that when the young blackbrush shoots were growing, these were red, very tender. He thought, oh, the goats are going to love this. This is great. And they would never touch it. And he couldn't understand why. And everyone back then had said, well, it's because goats are nutritional idiots. They don't know what's good for them. But it bothered Fred because they not only would they not nibble it, they would avoid it. And eventually he figured out that there was a toxin in it. And the toxin had a flavor that was telling the goats, don't eat me. Because at one point in the goat's life, the goat did eat it and it got sick. So this awakened this idea in Fred that of nutritional wisdom, that the flavor of what the goats were eating were telling them something. So on this level, it was...
Did he put Dorito dust
on the brush? And they loved it. And he made a lot of money from the... No. But then what he started to do later on was experiments where he started to see, well, could flavoring, instead of just warning a goat away from something, could it actually tell me this is good? So in a really neat experiment, he made goats deficient in phosphorus. And then he... This is really weird, and it's hard to understand, but these were a bunch of phosphorus-deficient goats. They're lacking an essential mineral. If this were to continue, they would die.
And phosphorus is a life mineral. If you're not familiar with it, need it for
every
process in your body.
It's essential for metabolism, for bone growth. So he took some of these goats, and one day, phosphorus-deficient, one day he pumped water into their stomach through a tube and then gave them a coconut flavoring. Sounds weird, I know. The next day, he would put phosphorus into their stomach through a tube, and then he would give them a maple flavoring. He didn't want them to taste the phosphorus. He just wanted to set up an association between the nutrient that gets in the gut and the flavor that gets in the mouth. And what he found is later, when he would give these phosphorus-deficient goats a choice between coconut or maple...
Because he was flavoring the food that they were eating after putting the phosphorus into introducing it to their bodies.
The phosphorus-deficient goats would always go for the maple because the maple was telling their bodies, this has got phosphorus, this is what you need. Now, you might be thinking, well, maybe goats are just like me and they love maple. Who doesn't love maple syrup? Well, over in another pen, he reversed it, where he paired the phosphorus with the coconut, and those goats loved coconut. They didn't love maple. So what he started to measure were what's called a flavor-nutrient interaction, where a flavor is a signal to your body, you're getting this nutrient. Well, one of the interesting things to think about, we tend to think of this all in terms of flavor. This flavor is telling you this or that. But what happens if you start giving yourself nutrients? And that's what we do every time we start adding nutrients like riboflavin and niacin and the gang to all those sugary cereals we feed our kids. What happens when you do that? Could you be turning off the desire? Let's take niacin. There's a lot of niacin in peas. If you put niacin in your Frosted Flakes or your Lucky Charms or whatever, is that turning off the desire in a little kid to actually eat a green pea? Because why would they need a green pea? They're getting everything they need from their sugary cereal. So this actually all comes back to chickens. Because the whole reason we were able to grow chickens in factories is because we figured out essential nutrients. Way back in the day, the whole reason people sent their chickens outside is because if all you did was feed them grain in the barn, they'd die because they wouldn't get their essential nutrients. But when we figured out the essential nutrients, we started sprinkling it into chicken feed. And all of a sudden, chickens don't need to go outside. They can just sit inside all day long and eat a high energy diet.
And when you say nutrients, you're talking you're also referring to like the chickens eating like a dead animal or a maggot or a bug or a, all of it combined, but what those things all combined had.
That's right. They would get that. Yes, exactly. A chicken would get its niacin from a dead frog or a grasshopper or a leaf. That was in the old days. But once once we figured that out, we could put it in chicken feed. Well, that's what we're doing to our own feed. We're loading it full of nutrients. And guess what? We're not dying of nutritional deficiencies. No one's got rickets. No one's got pellagra. No one's got scurvy. But we're looking an awful lot like modern chickens, which is if we get plump when we're young and we end up getting metabolic disease. And that's why I think, even though we think adding nutrients to food is a good idea, I don't think it is. I think the way to get nutrients is by eating real foods. What's really interesting is if you look at countries like Italy and France, they don't do nutritional enrichment. The French consider their flour sacred. They will not monkey around with it. And astonishingly, not only do they have a higher, generally speaking, culturally, a more of a love of vegetables there, they are not dying of pellagra and scurvy and rickets. So it's very counterintuitive to say this, but I think we should look at things like adding nutrients to junk food, because I don't think it's a good idea. Because you end up enabling a terrible diet. And I think we might also be turning off our desire, the enjoyment we get from real food by doing that.
It's incredibly interesting. It's amazing to see it all put together in a way that, you know, flavor, nutrition, its impact on gastronomy and health.
Yeah.
You know, who would have thought something that, you know, tastes better is better for us? You know, in the end, when you're talking about this real chicken,
real flavor. What I talk about in the book is synthetic flavor and real flavor. Everyone always says, oh, natural flavor. And then I say, no, we cannot talk about natural flavors because the FDA has totally screwed that up. There's all these natural flavors in yogurt and granola bars and soft drinks. They're no different than artificial flavors. Chemically speaking, they're the same thing. They're allowed to call them natural for reasons only a lawyer with a degree in organic chemistry could understand, but they are the same things. So flavor helps us when it's expressed in something that grew on a farm, a plant, or a dead animal. But when humans start monkeying around with flavor, that's where we get into problems. So that's why I talk about real flavor versus synthetic flavor.
You talk a little bit about rice in the book, I believe, or a lot. And I'm somewhat of a sake enthusiast, maybe an amateur or amateur professional sake enthusiast. But with sake, the more that you mill the rice, the purer the sake is. And I kind of came to this epiphany years ago when I started saying, well, why couldn't you make sake with brown rice? And it's because of all the nutrients on the outside of each piece of rice. And then I started researching what are they milling away? And the list is like all these amazing things. And I kind of had this epiphany of like how much better brown rice is than,
yes,
you know, than all the others.
Well, it's funny. And it's funny you mentioned brown rice because that's where the penny dropped with the chickens. That's where we discovered vitamins was because of chickens. It was on a ship, I think, in Indonesia, the guy doing the studies. When the chickens ate white rice, they would get pellagra. Mm-hmm. And then one day he replaced their rice. The chef started using brown rice, and all of a sudden the chickens got better. And this guy said, there must be something in the brown rice. And that led us to, because back then they thought nutritional deficiencies were caused by viruses and things like that.
And what year is that?
Oh, that would have been close to the end of the last, or of the 1800s.
1800s, yeah.
Or early 1900s, yeah.
Awesome.
I always love the story about how pirates would sail across long expanses of water with citrus on board. They always had like a lime tree or something growing because, you know, scurvy is a deficiency of vitamin C. And just to the idea that we could have ever figured that out before knowing what the mechanism was,
well,
in our own way.
And that's a great point because I was talking to a plant scientist at one point in the book, and I said, because I was starting to get curious about nutritional wisdom, and I asked, and this guy was like an expert in vitamin C metabolism and fruit, and I said, well, when people had scurvy like 300 years ago, did they crave fruit? And the guy said, no, I don't think so, because we'd probably know it if they did. And I thought, Well, there's so much for my theory. But then I thought, well, I'm going to find a naval historian and ask him. And I found one, and he said, oh, absolutely. They were paralyzed by cravings for fruits and vegetables. Even before anyone had any idea that this could cure you, they craved it. And as soon as they would get on land, they would start eating them. So, yes, there's a long and fascinating history that we've completely ignored.
Thank you so much, Mark, for taking the time and coming on the main course today. I think you have put together an incredibly interesting book. It's really well researched, and I would encourage anyone who's interested in these topics, food, flavor, understanding a little bit more why they exist, how they exist, and the history behind it, to pick it up and give it a read. The Dorito Effect, published May 5th, and any other good ways for them to connect with you or find you?
My website is markschatzker.com, and everyone, I love answering questions, so people are free to email. It's always fun to talk about this stuff.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and happy Sunday, everyone.
Happy Sunday. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.